Disc 3.
The world really won't care who or what you slept or sleep with unless you do, I said to her more quietly. In fact, I think the jury will understand how it could have happened back then, when you were so young, and she was older and brilliant and striking to look at, when she was charismatic and attentive, and your supervisor. Like Tian, Lucy said, and I could not tell if she were mocking me. Tian is not a psychopath, I said. 4. The next morning I fell asleep in the rented LTD and woke up to cornfields and silos and stands of trees as old as the Civil War. Marina was driving, and we passed vast acres of vacant land strung with barbed wire and telephone lines, and front yards dotted with mailboxes painted like flower gardens and Uncle Sam. There were ponds and creeks and sod farms and cattle fields high with weeds. Mostly I noticed small houses with leaning fences and clotheslines sagging with scrubbed garments billowing in the breeze. I covered a yawn with my hand and averted my face, for I had always considered it a sign of weakness to look tired or bored. Within minutes we turned right on 715, or Beaver Dam Road, and we began to see cows. Barns were bleached gray, and it seemed people never thought to haul away their broken-down trucks. The owner of Hoot Owl Farm lived in a large white brick house surrounded by endless vistas of pasture and fence. According to the sign out front, the house had been built in 1730. Now it had a swimming pool and a satellite dish that looked serious enough to intercept signals from other galaxies. Betty Foster was out to greet us before we had gotten out of the car. She was somewhere in her 50s with sharp, regal features and skin deeply creased by the sun. Her long white hair was tucked in a bun, but she walked with the athletic spring of someone half her age, and her hand was hard and strong when she shook mine and looked at me with pained hazel eyes. "I'm Betty," she said, "and you must be Dr. Scarpetta, and you must be Captain Marino." She shook his hand, too, her movements quick and confident. Betty Foster wore jeans and a sleeveless denim shirt, her brown boots scarred and crusted with mud around the heels. Beneath her hospitality, other emotions smoldered, and she seemed slightly dazed by us, as if she did not know where to begin. "Kenneth is in the riding ring," she told us. "He's been waiting for you, and I'll go on and tell you now that he's terribly upset. He loved those horses, every one of them, and of course he's devastated that someone died inside his house." "What exactly is your relationship to him?" Marino asked, as we started walking up the dusty road toward the stables. "I've bred and trained his horses for years," she said, "ever since he moved back to Warrenton. He had the finest Morgans in the Commonwealth, and quarter horses and thoroughbreds." "He would bring his horses to you?" I asked. "Sometimes he did that. Sometimes it was yearlings he would buy from me and just leave them here to be trained for 2 years. Then he'd add them to his stable. Or he'd breed racehorses and sell them when they were old enough to be trained for the track. And I also went up there to his farm, sometimes 2 or 3 times a week. Basically, I supervised." "And he has no stable hand?" I asked. "The last one quit several months ago. Since then, Kenny has been doing most of the work himself. It's not like he can hire just anyone. He has to be careful." "I'd like to know more about the stable hand," Marino said, taking notes. "A lovely old guy with a very bad heart," she said. "It may be that one horse survived the fire," I told her. She didn't comment at first, and we drew nearer to a big red barn and a "Beware of Dog" sign on a fence post. "It's a foal, I guess. Black," I went on. "A filly or a colt?" she asked. "I don't know. I couldn't tell the gender." "What about a star strip snip?" she asked, referring to the white stripe on the horse's forehead. "I wasn't that close," I told her. "Well, Kenny had a foal named Windsong," Foster said. The mother, Wind, ran the Derby and came in last, but just being in it was enough. Plus, the father had won a few big stake races, so Windsong was probably the most valuable horse in Kenny's stables. "Well, Windsong may have gotten out somehow," I said again, "and was spared. I hope he's not still out there running around. If he is, I doubt he will be for long. The police know about him." Marino was not particularly interested in the surviving horse, and as we entered the indoor ring, we were greeted by the sound of hooves and the clucking of bantam roosters and guinea hens that wandered about freely. Marino coughed and squinted because red dust was thick in the air, kicked up by the cantering of a chestnut Morgan mare. Horses in their stalls neighed and whinnied as horse and rider went by, and although I recognized Kenneth Sparks in his English saddle, I had never seen him in dirty denim and boots. He was an excellent equestrian, and when he met my eyes as he went by, he showed no sign of recognition or relief. I knew right then he did not want us here. "Is there some place we can talk to him?" I asked Foster. "There are chairs outside," she pointed. "Or you can use my office." Sparks picked up speed and thundered toward us, and the guinea hens lifted up their feathery skirts to hurry out of the way. "Did you know anything about a lady maybe staying with him in Warrenton?" I asked as we headed back outside again. "Did you ever see anyone when you went to work with his horses?" "No," Foster said. We picked plastic chairs and sat with our backs to the arena, overlooking woods. "But Lord knows, Kenny's had girlfriends before, and I don't always know about them," Foster said, turning around in her chair to look back inside the ring. "Unless you're right about Windsong, the horse Kenny's on now is the only one he has left. Black Opal. We call him Pal for short." Marino and I did not respond as we turned around to see Sparks dismount and hand the reins to one of Foster's stable hands. "Good job, Pal," Sparks said, patting the horse's handsome neck and head. "Any special reason this horse wasn't with the others on his farm?" I asked Foster. "Not quite old enough. He's a barely 3-year-old gelding who still needs training. That's why he's still here. Lucky for him." For a flicker, her face was contorted by grief, and she quickly looked away. She cleared her throat and got up from her chair. She walked away as Sparks came out of the arena adjusting his belt and the fit of his jeans. I got up and Marino and I respectfully shook his hand. He was sweating through a faded red Izod shirt, and he wiped his face with a yellow bandana he untied from his neck. "Please sit down," he graciously said, as if he were granting us an audience with him. We took our chairs again, and he pulled his out and turned it around to face us, the skin tight around eyes that were resolute but bloodshot. "Let me begin by telling you what I firmly believe right now as I sit in this chair," he said. "The fire was not an accident." "That's what we're here to investigate, sir," Marino said, more politely than usual. "I believe the motivation was racist in nature." Sparks' jaw muscles began to flex, and fury filled his voice. "And they, whoever they are, intentionally murdered my horses, destroying everything I love." "If the motive was racism," Marino said, "then why wouldn't they have checked to make sure you were home?" "Some things are worse than death. Perhaps they want me alive to suffer. You put two and two together." "We're trying to," Marino said. "Don't even consider pinning this on me." He pointed a finger at both of us. "I know exactly how people like you think," he went on. "Huh, I torched my own farm and horses for money. Now you listen to me good." He leaned closer to us. "I'm telling you now that I didn't do it. Would never, could never do it, will never do it. I had nothing to do with what happened. I'm the victim here, and probably lucky to be alive."
"Let's talk about the other victim," I quietly spoke. "A white female with long blonde hair as it looks now. Is there anyone else who might have been in your house that night?"
"No one should have been in my house," he exclaimed.
We are speculating that this person may have died in the master suite, I went on. Possibly the bathroom.
Whoever she was, she must have broken in, he said. Or maybe she was the one who set the fire and couldn't get out.
There's no evidence that anyone broke in, sir, Marino responded. And if your burglar alarm was set, it never went off that night. Only the smoke alarm.
I don't understand.
Sparks seemed to be telling the truth.
Of course I set the alarm before I left town.
And you were headed where? Marino probed.
London. I got there and was immediately notified. I never even left Heathrow and instantly caught the next flight back, he said. I got off in D.C. and drove straight here.
He stared blankly at the ground.
Drove in what? Marino asked. My Cherokee. I'd left it at Dulles in long-term parking.
You've got the receipt?
Yes.
What about the Mercedes at your house? Marino went on. Sparks frowned.
What Mercedes? I don't own a Mercedes. I have always bought American cars.
I remembered that this had been one of his policies that he had been quite vocal about.
There's a Mercedes behind the house. It burned up, too, so we can't tell much about it yet, Marino said. But it doesn't look like a recent model to me.
A sedan, sort of boxy like they were earlier on. Sparks just shook his head.
Then we might wonder if it was the victim's car, Marino deduced. Maybe someone who had come to see you unexpectedly? Who else had a key to your house and your burglar alarm code?
Good Lord, Sparks said as he groped for an answer.
Josh did. My stable hand, honest as the day is long. He quit for health reasons, and I never bothered changing the locks.
You need to tell us where to find him, Marino said.
He would never...
Sparks started to say, but he stopped, and an incredulous expression came over his face.
My God, he muttered with an awful sigh. Oh, my God.
He looked at me.
You said she was blonde, he asked.
Yes, I said.
Can you tell me anything else about the way she looked?
His voice was getting panicky. Appears to be slender, possibly white, wearing jeans, some sort of shirt and boots, lace-up boots versus Western.
How tall, he had to know.
I can't tell, not until I've examined her.
What about jewelry?
Her hands were gone. He sighed again, and when he spoke, his voice trembled.
Was her hair very long, like down to the middle of her back, and a very pale gold?
That's the way it appears at this time, I replied.
There was a young woman,
he began, clearing his throat several times.
My God, I haven't seen her in over a year. I have a place at Wrightsville Beach and met her there. She was a student at the university, or at least on and off she was. It didn't last long, maybe 6 months. And she did stay with me on the farm several times. The last time I saw her was there, and I ended the relationship because it couldn't go on.
Did she own an old Mercedes? Marino asked. Sparks shook his head. He covered his face with his hands as he struggled for composure.
A Volkswagen thing. Light blue, he managed to say. She didn't have any money. I gave her some in the end before she left. $1,000 cash. I told her to go back to school and finish. Her name is Claire Rawley, and I suppose she could have taken one of my extra keys without my knowing while she was staying on the farm. Maybe she saw the alarm code when I punched it in.
And you've had no contact with Claire Rawley for more than a year, I said.
Not one word, he replied. That seems so far in my past. It was a foolish thing, really. I saw her surfing and started talking to her on the beach in Wrightsville. I have to say she was the most splendid-looking woman I have ever seen. For a while I was out of my mind, then I came to my senses. There were many, many complications and problems. Claire needed a caretaker, and I couldn't be that.
I need to know everything about her that you can tell me, I said to him with feeling. Anything about where she was from, her family, anything that might help me identify the body or rule Claire Rawley out. Of course, I will contact the university as well.
"I've got to tell you the sad truth, Dr. Scarpetta," he said to me. "I never knew anything about her, really. Our relationship was mainly sexual, with me helping her out with money and her problems as best I could. I did care about her," he paused, "but it was never serious, at least not on my side. I mean, marriage was never in the offing."
He did not need to further explain. Sparks had power. He exuded it, and had always enjoyed almost any woman he wanted. But I felt no judgment now.
"I'm sorry," he said, getting up. "I can only tell you that she was rather much a failed artist, a want-to-be actor who spent most of her time surfing or wandering the beach. And after I'd been around her for a while, I began to see that something wasn't right about her. The way she seemed so lacking in motivation, and would act so erratic and glazed sometimes."
"Did she abuse alcohol?" I asked.
"No, it has too many calories."
"Drugs?"
"That's what I began to suspect, and it was something I could have no association with. I don't know."
"I need for you to spell her name for me," I said.
"Before you go walking off," Marino jumped in, and I recognized the bad cop edge to his tone. "You sure this couldn't be some sort of a murder-suicide? Only she kills everything you own and goes up in flames along with it? You sure there's no reason she might have done that, Mr. Sparks?"
"At this point, I can't be sure of anything,"
Sparks answered him as he paused near the barn's open door. Marino got up, too.
"Well, this ain't adding up, no disrespect intended," Marino said. "And I do need to see any receipts you have for your London trip, and for Dulles Airport. And I know ATF's hot to know about your basement full of bourbon and automatic weapons."
"I collect World War II weapons, and all of them are registered and legal," he said with restraint. "I bought the bourbon from a Kentucky distillery that went out of business 5 years ago. They shouldn't have sold it to me, and I shouldn't have bought it, but so be it."
"I think ATF's got bigger fish to fry than your barrels of bourbon," Marino said. "So if you got any of those receipts with you now, I'd appreciate your handing them over to me."
"Will you strip search me next, Captain?"
Sparks fixed hard eyes on him. Marino stared back as guinea hens kicked past again like breakdancers.
"You can deal with my lawyer," Sparks said, "and then I'll be happy to cooperate."
"Marino," it was my turn to speak. "If you'd give me just a minute alone with Mr. Sparks." Marino was taken aback and very annoyed. Without a word, he stalked off into the barn, several hens trotting after him. Sparks and I stood, facing each other. He was a strikingly handsome man, tall and lean, with thick gray hair. His eyes were amber, his features aristocratic, with a straight Jeffersonian nose and skin dark and as smooth as a man half his age. As he tightly gripped his riding crop, it seemed to fit his mood. Kenneth Sparks was capable of violence, but had never given into it, as best I knew.
"All right. What's on your mind?" he asked me suspiciously.
"I just wanted to make sure you understand that our differences of the past..." He shook his head and would not let me finish.
"The past is past," he curtly said.
"No, Kenneth, it isn't. And it's important for you to know that I don't harbor bad feelings about you," I replied. "That what's going on now is not related." When he had been more actively involved with the publishing of his newspapers, he had basically accused me of racism when I had released statistics about black-on-black homicides. I had shown citizens how many deaths were drug-related or involved prostitution, or were just plain hate of one black for another. His own reporters had taken several of my quotes out of context and had distorted the rest, and by the end of the day, Sparks had summoned me to his posh downtown office. I would never forget being shown into his mahogany space of fresh flowers and colonial furniture and lighting. He had ordered me, as if he could, that I demonstrate more sensitivity to African Americans and publicly retract my bigoted professional assessments. As I looked at him now, with sweat on his face and manure on his boots, it did not seem I was talking to the same arrogant man. His hands were trembling, his strong demeanor about to break.
"Will you let me know what you find out?" he asked, as tears filled his eyes, his head held high.
"I'll tell you what I can," I evasively promised.
"I just want to know if it's her, and that she didn't suffer," he said.
"Most people in fires don't. The carbon monoxide renders them unconscious long before the flames get close. Usually death is quiet and painless."
"Oh, thank God."
He looked up at the sky.
"Oh, thank you, God," he muttered.
5. I got home that night in time for a dinner I did not feel like cooking. Benton had left me 3 messages, and I had not returned any one of them. I felt strange. I felt an odd sensation of doom, and yet I felt a lightness around my heart that spurred me into working in my garden until dark, pulling weeds and clipping roses for the kitchen. The ones I chose were pink and yellow, tightly furled like flags before glory. At dusk, I went out to walk and wished I had a dog. For a while, I fantasized about that, wondering just what sort of dog I would have, were it possible and practical. I decided on a retired greyhound rescued from the track and from certain extermination. Of course, my life was too unkind for a pet. I pondered this as one of my neighbors came out of his grand stone home to walk his small white dog.
"Good evening, Dr. Scarpetta," the neighbor grimly said. "How long are you in town for?"
"I never know," I said, still imagining my greyhound.
"Heard about the fire?"
He was a retired surgeon, and he shook his head.
"Poor Kenneth."
"I suppose you know him," I said.
"Oh, yes."
"It is too bad. What kind of dog do you have?"
"He's a salad bar dog. Little bit of everything," my neighbor said.
He walked on, taking out a pipe and lighting up, because his wife, no doubt, would not let him smoke in the house. I walked past the homes of my neighbors, all different but the same, because they were brick or stucco and not very old. It seemed fitting that the sluggish stretch of the river in the back of the neighborhood made its way over rocks the same way it had 200 years before. Richmond was not known for change. When I reached the spot where I had found Wesley when he had been somewhat mad at me, I stood near that same tree, and soon it was too dark to spot an eagle or the river's rocks. For a time I stood staring at my neighbor's lights in the night, suddenly not having the energy to move, as I contemplated that Kenneth Sparks was either a victim or a killer. Then heavy footsteps sounded on the street behind me. Startled, I whipped around, gripping the canister of red pepper spray attached to my keys. Marino's voice was quickly followed by his formidable shape.
"Doc, you shouldn't be out here this late," he said.
I was too drained to resent him having an opinion on how I was spending my evening. "How did you know I was here?" I asked.
"One of your neighbors."
I did not care.
"My car's right over there," he went on. "I'll drive you home."
"Marino, can I never have a moment's peace?" I said, with no rancor, for I knew he meant no harm to me.
"Not tonight," he said. "I got some really bad news, and think you might want to sit down."
I immediately thought of Lucy and felt the strength go out of my knees. I swayed and put my hand on his shoulder as my mind seemed to shatter into a million pieces. I had always known the day might come when someone would deliver her death notice to me, and I could not speak or think. I was miles beyond the moment, sucked down deeper and deeper into a dark and terrible vortex. Marino grabbed my arm to steady me.
"Jesus," he exclaimed. "Let me get you to the car and we'll sit down."
"No," I barely said, because I had to know. "How's Lucy?" He paused for a moment and seemed confused.
"Well, she don't know yet, unless she's heard it on the news," he replied.
"Know what?" I asked, as my blood seemed to move again.
"Carrie Grethen's escaped from Kirby," he told me. "Sometime late this afternoon. They didn't figure it out until it was time to take the female inmates down for dinner."
We began walking quickly to his car as fear made him angry.
"And here you are, walking around in the dark with nothing but a keychain," he went on. "Shit! Goddamn son of a bitch!
Don't you do that anymore, you hear me? We got no idea where that bitch is, but one thing I know for a fact, as long as she's out, you ain't safe.
No one in the world is safe, I muttered, as I climbed into his car and thought of Benton alone at the beach.
Carrie Greffin hated him almost as much as she hated me, or at least this was my belief. Benton had profiled her and was the quarterback in the game that had eventually resulted in her capture and Temple Galt's death. Benton had used the Bureau's every resource to lock Carrie away, and until now it had worked.
"Is there any way she might know where Benton is?" I said as Marino drove me to my house. "He's alone on an island resort. He probably takes walks on the beach without his gun, unmindful that there might be someone looking for him."
"Like someone else I know," Marino cut me off.
"Point well taken."
"I'm sure Benton already knows, but I'll call him," Marino said. "And I got no reason to think that Carrie would know about your place in Hilton Head. You didn't have it back then when Lucy was telling her all your secrets."
"That's not fair," I said, as he pulled into my driveway and came to an abrupt stop. "Lucy never meant it that way. She never meant to be disloyal, to hurt me." I lifted the handle of my door.
"At this point, it don't matter what she meant." He blew smoke out his window.
"How did Carrie get out?" I asked. "Kirby's on an island, and not easily accessible."
"No one knows. About 3 hours ago, she was supposed to go down to dinner with all the other lovely ladies, and that's when the guards realized she was gone. Boom! No sign of her. And about a mile away, there's an old footbridge that goes over the East River into Harlem."
He tossed the cigarette butt on my driveway.
"All anyone can figure is maybe she got off the island that way. Cops are everywhere, and they got choppers out to make sure she's not still hiding somewhere on the island. But I don't think so. I think she's planned this for a while and timed it exactly. We'll hear from her all right. You can bet on that."
I was deeply unsettled when I went inside my house and checked every door and set the alarm. I then did something that was rare and unnerving for me. I got my Glock 9mm pistol from a drawer in my office and secured every closet in every room on each floor. I stepped into each doorway, the pistol firm in both hands as my heart hammered. By now, Carrie Greffin had become a monster with supernatural powers. I had begun to imagine that she could evade any security system and would glide out of the shadows when I was feeling safe and unaware. There seemed to be no presence in my two-story stone house but me, and I carried a glass of red burgundy into my bedroom and got into my robe. I called Wesley again and felt a chill when he did not pick up the phone. I tried once more at almost midnight, and still he did not answer.
"Dear God," I said, alone in my room.
Lamplight was soft and cast shadows from antique dressers and tables that had been stripped down to old gray oak, because I liked flaws and the stress marks of time. Pale rose draperies stirred as air flowed out from vents, and every movement unglued me more, no matter the explanation. With each passing moment, my brain was further overruled by fear as I tried to repress images from the past I shared with Carrie Greffin. I hoped Benton would call. I told myself he was okay, and that what I needed was sleep. So I tried to read Seamus Heaney's poetry and dozed off somewhere in the middle of the spoonbait. The phone rang at 2:20 a.m. and my book slid to the floor.
"Scarpetta!"
I blurted into the receiver as my heart pounded the way it always did when I was startled awake.
"Kay, it's me," Benton said.
"Sorry to call you this late, but I was afraid you were trying to reach me. Somehow the answering machine got turned off and, well, I went out to eat and then walked the beach for more than 2 hours. To think, I guess you know the news."
"Yes."
I was suddenly very alert.
"Are you all right?" he said, because he knew me well.
"I searched every inch of my house tonight before going to bed. I had my gun out and checked every closet and behind every shower curtain."
"I thought you probably would."
"It's like knowing a bomb is on the way in the mail."
"No, it's not like that, Kay, because we don't know one is coming or when or in what form. I wish we did. But that's part of her game, to make us guess."
"Benton, you know how she feels about you. I don't like you there alone.
Do you want me to come home?
I thought about this and had no good answer.
I'll get in my car right this minute, he added, if that's what you want.
Then I told him about the body in the ruins of Kenneth Sparks' mansion, and I went on and on about that and about my meeting with the tycoon on Hoot Owl Farm. I talked and explained while he patiently listened. The point is, I concluded, that this is turning out to be terribly complicated, if not bizarre, and there is so much to do. It makes no sense for your vacation to be ruined, too. And Marino's right. There's no reason to suspect that Carrie knows about our place in Hilton Head. You're probably safer there than here, Benton.
I wish she'd come here. His voice turned hard. I'd welcome her with my Sig Sauer and we could finally put an end to this.
I knew he truly wanted to kill her, and this was in a way the worst damage she could have done. It was not like Benton to wish for violence, to allow a shadow of the evil he pursued to fall over his conscience and heart, and as I listened, I felt my own culpability too. Do you see how destructive this is? I said, upset. We sit around talking about shooting her, strapping her into the electric chair, or giving her a lethal injection. She has succeeded in taking possession of us, Benton, because I admit that I want her dead about as much as I've ever wanted anything.
I think I should come on home, he again said.
We hung up soon after, and insomnia proved the only enemy of the night. It robbed me of the few hours left before dawn and ripped my brain into fragmented dreams of anxiety and horror. I dreamed I was late for an important appointment and got stuck in the snow and was unable to dial the phone. In my twilight state, I could not find answers in autopsies anymore and felt my life was over. And suddenly I drove up on a terrible car accident with bleeding bodies inside, and I could not make a move to help. I flipped this way and that, rearranging pillows and covers until the sky turned smoky blue and the stars went out. I got up and made coffee. I drove to work with the radio on, listening to repeated news breaks about the fire in Warrenton and a body that was found. Speculation was wild and dramatic about the victim being the famed media mogul, and I could not help but wonder if this amused Sparks just a little. I was curious why he had not issued a statement to the press, letting the world know he was quite alive, and again, doubts about him darkened my mind. Dr. Jack Fielding's red Mustang was parked behind our new building on Jackson Street, between the restored row houses of Jackson Ward and the Medical College of Virginia campus of Virginia Commonwealth University. My new building, which was also home to the forensic labs, was the anchor of 34 acres of rapidly developing data institutes known as Biotech Park. We had just moved from our old address to this new one but 2 months before, and I was still adjusting to modern glass and brick and lintels on top of windows to reflect the neighborhoods once there. Our new space was bright, with tan epoxy flooring and walls that were easily hosed down. There was much still to be unpacked and sorted and rearranged, and as thrilled as I was to finally have a modern morgue, I felt more overwhelmed than I had ever been. The low sun was in my eyes as I parked in the chief slot inside the covered bay on Jackson Street, and I unlocked a back door to let myself in. The corridor was spotless and smelled of industrial deodorizer, and there were still boxes of electrical wiring and switch plates and cans of paint parked against walls. Fielding had unlocked the stainless steel cooler, which was bigger than most living rooms, and he had opened the doors to the autopsy room. I tucked my keys into my pocketbook and headed to the lockers, where I slipped out of my suit jacket and hung it up. I buttoned a lab coat up to my neck and exchanged pumps for the rather gruesome black Reeboks I called my autopsy shoes. They were spattered and stained, and certainly a biological hazard, but they supported my less than youthful legs and feet, and never left the morgue. The new autopsy room was as much bigger than the one before as it was better designed to utilize space. No longer were large steel tables built into the floor, so they could be parked out of the way when not in use. The 5 new tables were transportable and could be wheeled out of the refrigerator and left and right-handed wall-mounted dissecting sinks, which accommodate both right and left-handed doctors.
Our new tables had roller trays, so we no longer had to use our backs to lift or move bodies, and there were non-clogging aspirators and eyewash stations and a special dual exhaust duct connected to the building's ventilation system. All in all, the Commonwealth had granted me most of what I needed to ease the Virginia Medical Examiner system into the second millennium. But in truth, there was no such thing as change, at least not for the better. Each year we explored more damage done by bullets and blades, and more people filed frivolous lawsuits against us, and the courts miscarried justice as a matter of course, because lawyers lied and jurors did not seem interested in evidence or facts anymore. Frigid air rushed as I opened the cooler's massive door, and I walked past body bags and bloody plastic shrouds and stiff protruding feet. Brown paper-bagged hands meant a violent death, and small pouches reminded me of a sudden infant death and the toddler who had drowned in the family pool. My fire case was swathed, broken glass and all, just as I had left it. I rolled the gurney out into a blaze of fluorescent light. Then I changed shoes again and walked to the other end of the first floor, where our offices and conference room were sequestered from the dead. It was almost 8:30, and residents and clerical staff were getting coffee and traveling the hall. We exchanged our usual detached good mornings as I headed toward Fielding's open door. I knocked once and walked in as he talked on the phone and hastily scribbled information on a call sheet. "Start again?" he said in his strong, blunt voice, as he cradled the receiver between his shoulder and chin and absently ran his fingers through his unruly dark hair. "What's the address? What's the officer's name?" He did not glance up at me as he wrote. "You got a local phone number?" He quickly read it back to make sure he'd gotten it right. "Any idea what kind of death this is? Okay. What cross street, and will I see you in your cruiser? All right, you're good to go." Fielding hung up and looked harried for so early in the morning. "What have we got?" I asked him as the business of the day began to mount. "Looks like a mechanical asphyxiation. A black female with a history of alcohol and drug abuse. She's hanging off the bed, head against the wall, neck bent at an angle inconsistent with life. She's nude, so I think I'd better take a look to make sure this isn't something else." "Someone definitely should take a look," I agreed. He got my meaning. "We can send Levine if you want." "Good idea, because I'm going to start the fire death and would like your help," I said. "At least in the early stages." "You got it." Fielding pushed back his chair and unfolded his powerful body. He was dressed in khakis, a white shirt with sleeves rolled up, rockports, and an old woven leather belt around his hard, trim waist. Past 40 now, he was no less diligent about his physical condition, which was no less remarkable than it had been when I had first hired him shortly after I had taken office. If only he cared about his cases quite so much. But he had always been respectful and faithful to me, and although he was slow and workmanlike, he was not given to assumptions or mistakes. For my purposes, he was manageable, reliable, and pleasant, and I would not have traded him for another deputy chief. We entered the conference room together, and I took my seat at the head of the long, glossy table. Charts and models of muscles and organs and the anatomical skeleton were the only decor, save for the same dated photographs of previous male chiefs who had watched over us in our previous quarters. This morning, the resident, a fellow, my three deputy and assistant chiefs, the toxicologist, and my administrators were present and accounted for. We had a medical student from MCV who was doing her elective here, and a forensic pathologist from London who was making the rounds in American morgues to learn more about serial murders and gunshot wounds. "Good morning," I said. "Let's go over what we've got, and then we'll talk about our fire fatality and the implications of that." Fielding began with the possible mechanical asphyxiation, and then Jones, the administrator for the Central District, which was the physical office where we were located, quickly ran through our other cases. We had a white male who fired 5 bullets into his girlfriend's head before blasting away at his own misguided brain. There were the sudden infant death and the drowning, and a young man who may have been changing out of his shirt and tie when he smashed his red Miata into a tree. "Wow," said the medical student, whose name was Sanford. How do you figure he was doing that?
Tank top half on, shirt and tie crumpled on the passenger seat, Jones explained. Seems he was leaving work to meet some friends at a bar. We've had these cases before. Someone changing clothes, shaving, putting on makeup while they're driving. That's when you want the little box on the death certificate that says manner of death was stupid, Fielding said.
Quite possibly all of you are aware that Carrie Grethen escaped from Kirby last night, I went on. Though this does not directly impact this office, clearly we should be more than a little concerned. I tried to be as matter-of-fact as possible. Expect the media to call.
They already have, said Jones as he peered at me over his reading glasses. The answering service has received 5 calls since last night.
About Carrie Grethen, I wanted to be sure.
Yes, ma'am, he said, and 4 more calls about the Warrington case.
Let's get to that, I said. There will be no information coming from this office at this point. Not about the escape from Kirby nor the Warrington death. Fielding and I will be downstairs the better part of the day, and I want no interruptions that aren't absolutely necessary. This case is very sensitive. I looked around the table at faces that were somber but alive with interest. At present, I don't know if we're dealing with an accident, suicide, or homicide, and the remains have not been identified. Tim, I addressed the toxicologist, let's get a stat alcohol and CO. This lady may have been a drug abuser, so I'll want a drug screen for opiates, amphetamines, and methamphetamine, barbiturates, cannabinoids, as fast as you can get it. He nodded as he wrote this down. I paused long enough to scan newspaper articles that Jones had clipped for me, then I followed the hallway back to the morgue. In the ladies' locker room, I removed my blouse and skirt and went to a cabinet to fetch a transmitter belt and mic that had been custom-designed for me by Lanier. The belt went around my upper waist under a long-sleeve blue surgical gown so the mic key would not come into direct contact with bloody hands. Last, I clipped the cordless mic to my collar, laced up my morgue shoes again, covered them with booties, and tied on a face shield and surgical mask. Fielding emerged into the autopsy room the same time I did. "Let's get her into X-ray," I said. We rolled the steel table across the corridor into the X-ray room and lifted the body and accompanying fire debris by corners of the sheets. This we transferred onto a table beneath the C-arm of the mobile digital imaging system, which was an X-ray machine and fluoroscope in one computer-controlled unit. I went through the various setup procedures, locking in various connecting cables and turning on the workstation with a key. Lighted segments and a timeline lit up on the control panel, and I loaded a film cassette into the holder and pressed a floor pedal to activate the video monitor. "Aprons," I said to Fielding. I handed him a lead-lined one that was Carolina blue. Mine was heavy and felt full of sand as I tied in back. "I think we're ready," I announced as I pressed a button. By moving the C-arm, we were able to capture the remains in real time from many different angles. Only unlike the examination of hospital patients, what we viewed did not breathe or beat or swallow. Static images of dead organs and bones were black and white on the video screen, and I saw no projectiles or anomalies. As we pivoted the C-arm some more, we discovered several radiopaque shapes that I suspected were metal objects mingled with the debris. We watched our progress on screen, digging and sifting with our gloved hands until I closed my fingers around 2 hard objects. One was the size and shape of a $0.50, the other smaller than that and square. I began cleaning them in the sink. "What's left of a small silver metal belt buckle?" I said as I dropped it into a plasticized carton, which I labeled with a magic marker. My other find was easier, and I did not have to do much to it to determine that it was a wristwatch. The band had burned off and the sooty crystal was shattered, but I was fascinated by the face, which upon further rinsing turned out to be a very bright orange, etched with a strange abstract design.
"Looks like a man's watch to me," Fielding observed.
"Women wear watches this big," I said. "I do, so I can see."
"Some kind of sports watch, maybe?"
"Maybe." We rotated the C-arm here and there, continuing to excavate as radiation from the X-ray tube passed through the body, and all the muck and charred material surrounding it. I spotted what looked like the shape of a ring located somewhere beneath the right buttock, but when I tried to grab it, nothing was there. Since the body had been on its back, much of the posterior regions had been spared, including clothing. I wedged my hands under the buttocks and worked my fingers into the back pockets of the jeans, recovering half a carat and what appeared to be a plain wedding band that at first looked like steel. Then I realized it was platinum. "That looks like a man's ring, too," Fielding said, "unless she had really big fingers." He took the ring from me to examine it more closely. The stench of burned, decaying flesh rose from the table as I discovered more strange signs pointing to what this woman may have done prior to dying. There were dark, coarse animal hairs adhering to wet, filthy denim, and though I couldn't be certain, I was fairly sure their origin was equine. "Nothing engraved in it," he said, sealing the ring inside an evidence envelope. "No," I confirmed with growing curiosity. "Wonder why she had it in her back pocket instead of wearing it."
"Good question."
"Unless she was doing something that might have caused her to take it off," he continued to think aloud. "You know, like people taking off their jewelry when they wash their hands."
"She may have been feeding the horses."
I collected several hairs with forceps.
"Maybe the black foal that got away," I supposed.
"Okay," he said, and he sounded very dubious. "And what? She's paying attention to the little guy, feeding him carrots, and then doesn't return him to his stall. A little later, everything burns, including the stables and the horses in them. But the foal gets away."
He glanced at me across the table.
"Suicide?" he continued to speculate. "And she couldn't bring herself to kill the colt? What's his name? Windsong?" But there were no answers to any of these questions right now, and we continued to make x-rays of personal effects and pathology to give us a permanent case record. But mostly we explored in real time on screen, recovering grommets from jeans and an intrauterine device that suggested she had been sexually active with males. Our findings included a zipper and a blackened lump the size of a baseball that turned out to be a steel bracelet with small links and a serpent silver ring that held 3 copper keys. Other than sinus configurations, which are as distinct as fingerprints in every human being, and a single porcelain crown on the right maxillary central incisor, we discovered nothing else obvious that might effect an identification. At close to noon, we rolled her back across the corridor into the autopsy room and attached her table to a dissecting sink in the farthest corner, out of the main traffic. Other sinks were busy and loud as water drummed stainless steel, and stepladders were scooted as other doctors weighed and sectioned organs and dictated their findings into tiny mics, while various detectives looked on. The chatter was typically blunt with fractured sentences, our communication as random and disjointed as the lives of our cases. "Excuse me, need to be right about where you are." "Darn, I need a battery." "What kind?" "Whatever the hell goes in this camera." $20, right front pocket. "Probably not robbery." "Who's gonna count pills? Got a shitload." "Dr. Scarpetta, we just got another case. Possible homicide," a resident loudly said as he hung up a phone that was designated for clean hands. "We may have to hold it until tomorrow," I responded as our workload worsened. "We've got the gun from the murder-suicide," one of my assistant chiefs called out. "Unloaded?" I answered back. "Yeah." I walked over to make sure, for I never made assumptions when firearms came in with bodies. The dead man was big and still dressed in faded glory jeans, the pockets turned inside out by police. Potential gunshot residue on his hands was protected by brown paper bags, and blood trickled from his nose when a wooden block was placed beneath his head. "Do you mind if I handle the gun?" I asked the detective, above the whine of a striker saw. "Be my guest. I've already lifted prints." I picked up the Smith & Wesson pistol and pulled back the slide to check for a cartridge, but the chamber was clear. I dabbed a towel over the bullet wound in the head as my morgue supervisor, Chuck Ruffin, honed a knife with long sweeps over a sharpening stone. "See the black around there and the muzzle imprint?" I said as the detective and a resident leaned close. You can see the sight here. It's contact right-handed. The exit's here, and you can see by the dripping he was lying on his right side. That's how we found him, the detective said, as the saw whined on and a bony dust drifted through the air. Be sure to note the caliber, make, and model, I said as I returned to my own sad chore. And is the ammunition ball versus hollow point? Ball. Remington 9mm. Fielding had parallel parked another table nearby and covered it with a sheet that he had piled with the fire debris that we had already sifted through. I began measuring the lengths of her badly burned femurs in hopes I could make an estimate of height. The rest of her legs were gone from just above the knees to the ankles, but her feet had been spared by her boots. In addition, she had burn amputations of her forearms and hands. We collected fragments of fabric and drew diagrams and collected more animal hairs, doing all that we could before beginning the difficult task of removing the glass. Let's get the warm water going, I said to Fielding. Maybe we can loosen without tearing skin. It's like a damn roast stuck to the pan. Why are you guys always making food analogies? Came a deep, sure voice I recognized. Tian McGovern, in full morgue protective garb, was walking toward our table. Her eyes were intense behind her face shield, and for an instant we stared straight at each other. I was not the least bit surprised that ATF would have sent a fire investigator to watch the post-mortem examination, but I had never expected McGovern to show up. How's it going in Warrington? I asked her. Working away, she replied. We haven't found the governor's body, which is a good thing since he's not dead. Cute, Fielding said. McGovern positioned herself across from me, standing far enough back from the table to suggest to me that she had seen very few autopsies. So, what exactly are you doing? She asked as I picked up a hose. We're going to run warm water between the skin and the glass in hopes we can peel the two apart without further damage, I replied. And what if that doesn't work? Then we got a big fat mess, Fielding said. Then we use a scalpel, I explained. But this was not necessary. After several minutes of a constant warm bath, I began to very slowly and gently separate the thick broken glass from the dead woman's face, the skin pulling and distorting as I peeled, making her all the more horrible to look at. Fielding and I worked in silence for a while, gently laying shards and sections of heat-stressed glass into a plastic tub. This took about an hour, and when we were done, the stench was stronger. What was left of the poor woman seemed more pitiful and small, and the damage to her head was even more striking. My God, McGovern said as she stepped closer. That's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. The lower part of the face was chalky bone, a barely discernible human skull with open mandibles and crumbling teeth. Most of the ears were gone, but from the eyes up, the flesh was cooked and so remarkably preserved that I could see the blonde fuzz along the hairline. The forehead was intact, although slightly abraded by the removal of the glass, so that it was no longer smooth. If there had been wrinkles, I could not find them now. I can't figure out what the hell this is, Fielding said as he examined the bits of material mingled with hair. It's everywhere, all the way down to her scalp. Some of it looked like burned paper, while other small pieces were pristinely preserved and a neon pink. I scraped some of it onto my scalpel and placed it into another carton. We'll let the labs take a crack at it, I said to McGovern. Absolutely, she answered. The hair was 18¾ inches long, and I saved a strand of it for DNA, should we ever have a pre-mortem sample for comparison. If we trace her back to someone missing, I said to McGovern, and you guys can get hold of her toothbrush, we can look for buccal cells. They line the mucosa of the mouth and can be used for DNA comparison. A hairbrush would be good, too. She made a note of this. I moved a surgical lamp closer to the left temporal area, using a lens to painstakingly examine what appeared to be hemorrhage in tissue that had been spared. It seems we have some sort of injury here, I said. Definitely not skin splitting or an artifact of fire. probably an incision with some sort of shiny debris embedded inside the wound. Could she have been overcome by CO and fallen and hit her head? McGovern voiced the same question others had. She would have had to have hit it on something very sharp, I said as I took photographs. Let me look, Fielding said, and I handed him the lens. I don't see any torn or ragged edges, he remarked as he peered. No, not a laceration, I agreed. This looks more like something inflicted by a sharp instrument. He returned the lens to me, and I used plastic forceps to delicately scrape the shiny debris from the wound. I swiped it onto a square of clean cotton twill. On a nearby desk was a dissecting microscope, and I placed the cloth on the stage and moved the light source so that it would reflect off the debris. I looked through the eyepiece lens as I manipulated the coarse and fine adjustments. What I saw in the circle of reflected illumination were several silvery segments that had the striated, flattened surfaces of metal shavings, such as the turnings made by a lathe. I fitted a Polaroid microcam to the microscope and took high-resolution instant color photographs. Take a look, I said. Fielding, then McGovern, bent over the microscope. Either of you ever seen anything like that? I asked. I peeled open the developed photographs to make certain they had turned out all right. It reminds me of Christmas tinsel when it gets old and wrinkled, Fielding said. Transferred from whatever cutter, was all McGovern had to say. I would think so, I agreed. I removed the square of white cloth from the stage and preserved the shavings between cotton balls, which I sealed inside a metal evidence button. One more thing for the labs, I said to McGovern. How long will it take? McGovern said. Because if there's a problem, we can do the work at our labs in Rockville. There won't be a problem. I looked at Fielding and said, I think I can handle it from here. Okay, he said. I'll get started on the next one. I opened up the neck to look for trauma to those organs and muscles beginning with the tongue, which I removed while McGovern looked on with stoicism. It was a grim procedure that separated the weak from the strong. Nothing there, I said, rinsing the tongue and blotting it dry with a towel. No bite marks that might be indicative of a seizure, no other injuries. I looked inside the glistening smooth walls of the airway and found no soot, meaning she was no longer breathing when heat and flames had reached her. But I also found blood, and this was further ominous news. More pre-mortem trauma, I said. Possible something fell on her after she was dead? McGovern asked. It didn't happen that way. I noted the injury on a diagram and dictated it into the transmitter. Blood in the airway means she inhaled it, or aspirated, I explained, meaning obviously that she was breathing when the trauma occurred. What sort of trauma? She then asked. A penetrating injury. The throat stabbed or cut. I see no other signs of trauma to the neck, no contusions or broken bones. Her hyoid's intact, and there's fusion of the greater horn and body, possibly indicating she's older than 20 and most likely wasn't strangled manually or with a ligature. I began to dictate again. Structures of the upper neck are burned away, I said into the small mic on my gown. Heat coagulated blood in the distal trachea, primary, secondary, and tertiary bronchi. Hemoaspiration and blood in the esophagus. I made the Y incision to open up the dehydrated, ruined body, and for the most part the rest of the autopsy proved to be rather routine. Although the organs were cooked, they were within normal limits, and the less massive, gracile pelvis verified the gender as female. There was blood in her stomach, too. Otherwise, it was empty and tubular, suggesting she hadn't been eating very much. But I found no disease and no other injuries, old or new. Height I could not positively ascertain, but I could estimate by using Trotter and Glazer regression formula charts to correlate femur length to the victim's stature. I sat at a nearby desk and thumbed through Bass's Human Osteology until I found the appropriate table for American white females. Based on a 50.2 millimeter or approximately 20-inch femur, the predicted height would have been 5'10". Weight was not so exact, for there was no table, chart, or scientific calculation that might tell me that. In truth, we usually got a hint of weight from the size of clothing left, and in this case the victim had been wearing size 8 jeans. So based on the data I had, I intuited that she had been between 120 and 130 pounds. In other words, I said to McGovern, she was tall and very slim. We also know she had long blonde hair, was probably sexually active, may have been comfortable around horses, and was already dead inside Sparks's Warrenton house before the fire got to her. I also know that she received significant pre-mortem injury to her neck and was cut right here on her left temple. I pointed. How these were inflicted, I can't tell you. I got up from my chair and gathered paperwork, while McGovern looked at me, her eyes shadowed by thought. She took off her face shield and mask and untied her gown in back. If she had a drug problem, is there any way you might be able to tell that? She asked me as the phone rang and rang. Toxicology will certainly tell us if she had drugs on board, I said. There may also be crystals in her lungs or foreign body granulomas from cutting agents like talc and fibers from the cotton used to strain out impurities. Unfortunately, the areas where we might be most likely to find needle tracks are missing. What about her brain? Would chronic drug abuse cause any damage that you might be able to see? For example, if she started having severe mental problems, was getting psychotic and so on. It sounds like Sparks thought she had some sort of mental illness, McGovern then said. For example, what if she were depressive or manic depressive? Could you tell? By now, the skull had been open, the rubbery, fire-shrunken brain sectioned and still on the cutting board. In the first place, I answered, nothing is going to be helpful post-mortem because the brain is cooked. But even if that were not the case, looking for a morphological correlate to a particular psychiatric syndrome is in most cases still theoretical. A widening of the sulci, for example, and reduced gray matter due to atrophy might be a signpost if we knew what the weight of the brain originally was when she was healthy. Then maybe I could say, okay, her brain weighs 100 grams less now than it did, so she might have been suffering from some sort of mental disease. Unless she has a lesion or old head injury that might suggest a problem, the answer to your question is no, I can't tell. McGovern was silent, and it was not lost on her that I was clinical and not the least bit friendly. Even though I was aware of my rather brittle demeanor around her, I could not seem to soften it. I looked around for Ruffin. He was at the first dissecting sink, suturing a Y incision in long strokes of needle and twine. I motioned to him and walked over. He was too young to worry about turning 30 any time soon, and had gotten his training in an OR and a funeral home. "Chuck, if you can finish up here and put her back in the fridge," I said to him. "Yes, ma'am." He returned to his station to finish his present task while I peeled off gloves and dropped them and my mask into one of many red biological hazard containers scattered around the autopsy room. "Let's go to my office and have a cup of coffee," I suggested to McGovern, in an attempt to be a little more civil. "And we can finish this discussion." In the locker room, we washed with antibacterial soap and I got dressed. I had questions for McGovern, but in truth I was curious about her, too. "Getting back to the possibility of drug-induced mental illness," McGovern said as we followed the corridor. "Many of these people self-destruct, right? In one way or another. They die in accidents, commit suicide, and that gets us back to the big question," she said. "Is that what happened here? Possible she was whacked out and committed suicide?" "All I know is she has injury that was inflicted before death," I pointed out again. "But that could be self-inflicted if she were not in her right mind," McGovern said. "God knows the kinds of self-mutilation we've seen when people are psychotic." This was true. I had worked cases in which people had cut their own throats, or stabbed themselves in the chest, or amputated their limbs, or shot themselves in their sexual organs, or walked into a river to drown. Not to mention leaps from high places and self-immolations. The list of horrendous things people did to themselves was much too long, and whenever I thought I'd seen it all, something new and awful was rolled into our bay.
The phone was ringing as I unlocked my office, and I grabbed it just in time. "Scarpetta," I said.
"I've got some results for you," said Tim Cooper, the toxicologist. "Ethanol, methanol, isopropanol, and acetone are zero. Carbon monoxide is less than 7%. I'll keep working on the other screens."
"Thanks. What would I do without you?" I said.
This book is continued on Disc 4.